Well, welcome back to the Building Manage podcast. My name is Matt Osborne and I am your host. This is proudly recorded through Anchor by Spotify. Well, things have been quite busy. Things have been quite hectic. Really want to reach out to all of those people who have unfortunately been suffering through the floods, particularly up in Queensland and New South Wales, and I do really wish everyone the best, and my heartfelt feelings go out to those people and those families who have lost loved ones in the floods. Quite devastating. I really do hope that everyone is able to get back onto their feet, and I know that there's a number of support groups out there that people can reach out to in order to get help. And on another note, look, this week's episode of the Building Manager podcast, I am interviewing Bruce Bromley. He's the Managing Director of Equal Access Group. And Bruce will talk today about accessibility, inclusivity, and disabilities. He is quite an expert with the SDA, NDIA, and has a great passion for the industry. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the show, and I'll see you on the other side. Well, welcome, Bruce Bromley, to the Building Manage podcast. Bruce is the Managing Director of Equal Access Group, Proprietary Limited. Bruce, would you mind just sharing with our listeners a little bit about yourself and how you developed the company Equal Access Group?
Sure. My background is working in architecture and as a designer and project manager, pretty much going back to the mid-80s. Wow. So, yeah, I've been involved with the building industry, quite extensively. So then I started Equal Access 17 years ago to assist designers, certifiers, builders to respond to their obligations under the Disability Discrimination Act. Previously, I'd been working with architects, working with education department, councils and all that, and became a specialist in disability access compliance. So it was sort of a natural progression to start my own business. Mm. Started with no clients, just married, new baby, mortgage, and to the point now where we've got about 14 staff and continuing to grow. So it's been very rewarding.
Awesome.
So with Equal Access, we started just purely on the access consulting side of things. And a few years into that, we kept getting asked the question, what do we do about people with disabilities in an emergency? How do we get them out of buildings? And it was one of the things, and sadly still is, lacking in Australia on how do we evacuate people. So I started looking at what some of the overseas trends were, and we just initially brought out a few evacuation chairs to see what the demand was. And we recognised there was a demand, and we've continued to grow that part of the business. Then we've also got SDA Consulting, who specialise in specialist disability accommodation under the NDIA, and a new business called Access and Safety, which specialises in, as the name suggests, access and safety equipment. We're about to launch a brand new device which allows child safety gates, so childcare centres, aquatic centres, maternal child health, which are all inaccessible for people with disabilities due to the height of the controls. This device replaces the bottom section of the Magna Latch, and we've worked closely with the guys at Magna Latch. That allows a wheelchair user or someone short stature to use the MLAC key to then access those gates. So making them, again, universally accessible and not exclusive to able-bodied people.
Excellent. I can certainly vouch, I guess, for people in those circumstances trying to reach certain things. I recall not recently going to a hotel and we were given a high floor. I'm in a wheelchair, as you know. Oh, there's no way I could have reached the top button. You know, it's just crazy. But, yeah, I'm sure things will change. But you mentioned safety there. As you know, October is generally recognised National Health and Safety Month. And, you know, last month, like yourself, I was watching the webinar regarding inclusivity and accessibility in the workplace. And I really noticed that there was a stigma still attached to these areas. But I was also pleased to see that there have been some changes, and like the changes you're making, I'm pretty excited to see some more to come. But how do you believe developers maybe and builders can adapt their buildings to suit the needs of people with disabilities while maintaining the needs of inclusivity?
Well, in terms of building access, it's already in the building code, so that shouldn't be too difficult of an exercise for them. But that only sets really a minimum standards. It doesn't mean things like kitchens are accessible. You know, if I want to go make a coffee or I want to wash my glass or anything in the sink, if the cupboards are completely built under, you know, they're not accessible. So there are simple things which aren't expensive that can increase that inclusivity. Governments, councils particularly, are very are very mindful of this and adopt it just as normal policy now. And you know, that's refreshing to see. The other real issue we see is, you know, or what I see is fire and life safety for people with disability. You know, it's a passion of mine. It's something I've been doing probably 14, 15 years now. I sit on the Standards Development Committee for AS3745, which is workplace evacuation.
Okay.
But we still have a building code that doesn't have any prescriptive requirements that deals with the evacuation of people with disability. And this, I just don't understand. We've got performance requirements for people with, which outline the occupant profiles must be considered in developing fire engineered solutions, but we don't have any education in place to actually train those fire engineers, building surveyors on what actually needs to be provided in that building. Yeah. You know, the stereotypical approach for them is go, oh, disability, wheelchair, oh, we can't use it unless we've got a fire safe lift. If it's an old building, we don't have fire separated lift, there's no way that egress can be provided. So, you know, what do we do in that sort of circumstance? So when we then start looking at the OH&S legislation, organisations firstly have to assess the risk, identify any foreseeable hazards, then utilising the hierarchy of control, they must implement control measures. This is specifically states that the obligation to plan for all emergencies and provide training and practice is appropriate to the nature of the risk within that workplace. We then have AS3745, which discusses occupants and visitors with disability. It provides recommendations such as personal emergency evacuation plans, refuges, evacuation chairs, but again, non-mandatory requirements. So unless there's a reason for organisations to take these sorts of things seriously, if they have a staff member when they move in, or you know, it just simply gets ignored. This sort of thing really has to start at the legislation side of things. If we look at 3745, it says consideration shall be given to the use of stairwell evacuation devices. So again, it's a non-mandatory requirement. You know, one simple word change, shall change it to should. Consideration should be given. I would love to see that, you know, those devices provided by default, but unfortunately, you know, it's just how the legislation is. And I think there's a lot of not wanting to spend money, or it's viewed on as unnecessary expenditure. And how often have you seen a fire engineered solution? How often have you seen evacuation policy that really doesn't address disability? You know, does it address mobility impaired staff? Does it address vision impaired staff, staff that are deaf that might be working in an office on their own and won't be able to hear fire alarms? You know, what policies or what procedures are being put in place to assist in their evacuation? People that are claustrophobic, having to go into a fire stair that's full of people and could potentially panic and stop.
Yeah.
You know, what's going to happen in that circumstance? There's just so many variables that aren't really considered. We get told, yeah, but how many people should we allow for? How do we base it? And I simply say, have a look at the Australian Bureau of Statistics. You've got a snapshot of the communities there. Use that demographic data to actually base your evacuation planning, base your fire engineered solution on, and actually have subheadings for those disabilities, what needs to be put in place so all people are protected. And it's not just people with permanent disability that need to be considered. Organisations will regularly have staff with temporary disability. Mm. It might be a sporting accident. They could be post-operative after surgery. So for a period of time, their ability to evacuate will have changed. Have they prepared a plan on how that staff member will be managed in an emergency? And I would say majority of cases, the answer would be no.
No. Yeah, and I think what you mentioned before about the standard, and I know it's the Australian standards are really just there as the basic rules, but you said changing the word to should. I think going even one step further and changing that should to will. We will do such and such, and that really would, I think, place that emphasis back onto the builders, the developers, the architects, everyone that's involved in the building, so that they have to. And, you know, there's a lot of these standards that are just so invalid because they become a recommendation, not a requirement.
Mm.
And so as soon as something becomes a recommendation, then it's, oh, we don't really have to do that because it's only recommended. Mm. But, you know, it's absolute madness. And all of those ideas and situations you gave there are just prime examples of what people are, you know, where people are not thought about.
Yep, couldn't agree more. And yeah. I would also add to that list of people is the property managers at the end of the day, or the building managers, because again, they're the ones that are responsible to get people out of the buildings. They're the ones that schedule evacuation drills, they schedule warden training. You know, part of that should be, if there's an evacuation, we need to look at how are we going to get Mary off the 43rd floor? She's in a wheelchair, and you know, they might not have fire separated lifts or anything like that, or they might still be able to use the lifts, but until the emergency services arrive on site to assess the incident, mm. you know, those decisions can't be made. Therefore, that person's stuck on site, you know, in a wait in place approach, which is what's pretty typical.
Yep.
And they'll argue, oh yeah, but we've got sprinklers, so it'll slow the spread of flames and all that, but it doesn't stop the smoke. And no. That's the smoke that's what kills. Then we hear people saying, oh, let's wheel the person with a disability out onto the stair landing. So let's make it even harder for everyone else to evacuate. And unless it's a pressurized stair, there's still a chance that we're going to get smoke ingress into those stair environments. So yeah. There's still not satisfactory solutions being offered.
No, absolutely correct. And, you know, I'll always recall as a building manager myself, one of those ideas that, you know, I came up with was, you know, recognising in these high-rise residential complexes. Now, I ran a building, 67 stories, 473 apartments, and, you know, we had some retired people. We had some people that were deaf, and we had some elderly people, and I can tell you they weren't going to be walking down 60 flights of stairs. And so the idea came up then was, we've got this big whiteboard right opposite the fire indication panel. All right, so, you know, Mr. Jones in room 471 or whatever it was, he's deaf. You've got Mr. Smith, whatever his name, you know, I'm on level 55, well, you know, he's 82, et cetera. And all of these other ideas really, you know, building managers, I think, as you say, have a bit of a responsibility, as well as the strata managers, to put together things like this so that they can go onto a board or whatever it is near the FIP, because, you know, the building manager is not always going to be sitting in their office. And so when a fire alarm goes off, as the brigade come into the FIP area, then they're going to be able to look at this board and go, oh, okay, we've got to go and get these people off these floors. And, you know, it's just, I've never seen it since, Bruce. And it really is something that needs some improvement on. And one of the interviews I did, you know, late last year was with Brett Emery from FireMate. Now, FireMate have produced this fabulous platform or application, I guess, that links into the fire systems. And, you know, I thought, what a good place to put these people into in regards to like the Mr. Smith on that floor, and, you know, putting people's names in there so that as an alarm came up, there was an alert that popped up on the screen that said, okay, you've got these people with disabilities or these people with injuries, like you've mentioned, that we need to go and attend to first. So, you know, I think, you know, it really needed just to be added into all of those platforms.
And it's not something that's difficult to, even a manual entry, you know, you have an envelope paper occupant profile and the FIP for smaller buildings, something like that is not hard to do. And, you know, it generally won't have details of medical conditions. It will just say, in a wheelchair, needs evacuation assistance. You'll see, you know, people in buildings that might have disability, but and they're also on life safety equipment. So they're on respirators. So, you know, you've then got a note, someone needs to carry that. There was an article a few years ago, and I've actually just put it back on the EvacuLife website last year, about a gas explosion, a water boiler at the top of a residential tower up in Queensland. Right. And it has a lot of good data in it telling you how long it took to get the elderly residents and people with disability out. You know, we're into 4 and 5 hour time periods, and people will sort of wrongly assume that, oh, we've got the building's designed or the compartmentation is 2 hour fire design. Yeah, that's great. But it doesn't mean the building's going to be safe to occupy for that 2 hours. It just means the building's going to be structurally sound. It doesn't take into consideration particularly smoke ingress. But the article I'm talking about, it discusses it was taking 4 emergency service personnel to evacuate 1 person with a disability out of that building.
Wow.
But the key kicker was every 4 or 5 floors, they had a backup crew to change over because of how physically demanding it was for the fireys. So when you suddenly then look at that and go, okay, from the 40th floor, first responders arrive on site, they ascertain what the issue is. If the lifts aren't functioning, power failure or whatever's happened, you know, floods, for Christ's sake, what's been going on up in Queensland. They've then got to send personnel up those stairs. They've then got to bring people down those stairs. Now, if you've only got a 2 hour fire design on that building, you know, you've got questionable structural suitability then on the design. You know, do we have compartmentation? Do we have smoke protection for those residents? How are we actually going to evacuate them at the end of the day? So to me, that's you've sort of got me on the bandwagon. These are the questions I'm forever asking of fire engineers at the moment.
Well, and they need to be asked, and they not only need to be asked, but they also need to be acted upon. And you briefly mentioned the floods. Now, I was up in Brisbane running a building in 2011 and, you know, went to the assistance of some other building managers in the group that I was working for. And like you say, they had no lifts operation. They had no power. In fact, you know, I think they were able to get the lifts up, but there was water, obviously, in the lift shaft. But, you know, we had a situation that, you know, we had to not really carry, but, you know, assist someone down some stairs. Now, I don't know how many flights of stairs it was, but, you know, you're right, it's hard work. And it just don't have to think about fire. You've just got to think about all sorts of situations where you don't have power. Lightning strike in a building that perhaps even, you know, doesn't hit the lightning rod. In fact, you know, shuts off all the power. Or a power grid failure, for example. Now, I've been through, again, a power grid failure in a hotel in Brisbane many years ago. And fortunately, we didn't have a generator to run. And essentially, we just had to leave people in their rooms. But for people that wanted to come down, we had to go and escort them down these stairs. And it was, again, just a lot of work, but just they're not thought of. And I know it might be very hard to retrofit some of these ideas into the buildings. But from my experience in dealing with all of these situations directly, I really think it's a must. And I'm not just saying that now because I'm in a wheelchair, but you know, I've been through these situations of helping people down the stairs. Thankfully, I haven't been in any fire situation, but you know, we've, like you said, have had to conduct training every year. So we've had to, you know, walk up at however many flights of stairs just to get into that relevant area, and it's hard work. So I really do hope that, you know, the architects, the builders, and even the developers really start to put, you know, some action into place. One thing I really liked about that webinar was the idea around having the placement of buttons in specific locations and making that standard. I think one situation was around for blind people having to walk up to a lift, knowing that everything's going to be on one side, or into a toilet situation. And it's just really frustrating. And I've been to, I don't know how many different places that I would have thought had some really good quality setups. You know, going into a bathroom, for example, well, you've got to push the door open. Now, that's pretty hard in my situation. They should be automatic.
Absolutely.
But they're not. And it's just, so I'm not going to name the places, but I just can't believe it. In fact, there's a new shopping center that's just been built up the road, and there's two doors you've got to go through. One that's super heavy, and then when you get to the toilet, again, you've got to push the door open. And I sit there and I'm like, this isn't right, you know. They're really not thinking straight with all of these ideas.
Well, door forces at least should be set to the maximum of 20 newtons, which a person can pretty much push open with a finger or two fingers at the worst case scenario, and then ideally delay actions. But we've got a number of universities down here in Melbourne who just by default are now, with refurbishments, automating accessible toilet doors. We've got one council that's retrofitting, I think, most of their council buildings to ensure that all the accessible toilets have door automation. So again, it's possible, it's not difficult. No. And it does make a huge difference to the lives of people with disability.
Absolutely. Now, I know we've spoken about fire and safety and, you know, the importance of recognising the need to better support people with accessible requirements in order to safely get them out of the building. Now, I note that Equal Access Group have developed EvacuLife. Would you mind maybe just sharing the listeners a little bit about that?
Sure. So this is what I mentioned earlier. You know, a few years into Equal Access, we started looking at evacuation chairs. So evacuation chairs are a device that can easily take a person with a disability down multiple flights of stairs. They're not motorised and can simply be used by one staff member, one member of the emergency services. So when we look at that Queensland building I mentioned earlier, it took, I think it was 4.5 hours or 5 hours to get the last person with disability out of that building. Mm. And if we're looking on that staff or emergency service ratio of, you know, one person, eight emergency services, or 9 if there's respirators and that also have to be carried down. An evacuation chair allows a 1-to-1 or 1-to-2 ratio, but that person can then quite easily take someone down 20, 30 flights of stairs. Excellent. With very little physical exertion, very little risk to the occupant being evacuated. So they're a simple process. But again, there's something that's very easily, my personal opinion, and this is really not coming from the fact that we sell them, it comes from the fact that I work extensively in the disability consulting spaces. They should be mandatory, like fire extinguishers. So if you've got a fire extinguisher on the wall, there should be an evacuation chair right beside it. You know, we're not talking 20, 30,000. We're talking, I'm trying to think, our entry level one, which is our most popular, is around $1,300, $1,400. So wow. When you look at the payroll for an office floor, you know, $1,400 is to me an absolute pittance.
Yeah.
To the difference it can make in people's lives. If you've got multiple residents in, you know, accommodation, in a lot of cases, you won't have someone there to be able to use the chair to evacuate them out. So you will fall onto the emergency services. So again, my approach, and this is again with specialist disability accommodation, we should have one evacuation chair in each bedroom that's there ready to go for that person. So again, the emergency services get their fire indicator panel. Mary, level 42, uses a wheelchair, evacuation chair available on site, already set for the user. Yeah. So the emergency services immediately can go, okay, we'll send one person up or we'll send two people up, one to help with the transfer. So it allows their allocation of resources when arriving on site to be spread out more, especially if you've got a number of people that do need that evacuation.
Absolutely.
And yeah, we've got videos on the website. You can see how easy they are to use. I had one on one of my staff again in it last week because we had a not-for-profit organisation in the office, and I said, "Hey, have a quick look at these." And we're halfway down the stairs. I stopped this chair on the stair, and I was holding it in place with one finger. That's how well they function, and for people with disabilities. So there's OH&S risk again for the staff members or their colleagues is very low. We always suggest training. But it means you're not leaving friends, colleagues in the building for rescue. You know, work cover here in Victoria, we've got correspondence from them, and they say, yes, the policy we have is to leave the person in a safe place. Responded back, please define what a safe place is. Can't get an answer. And we have another couple of staff members to wait for them until emergency services arrive. I shock people when I do my training sessions and I go, if the building's on fire or there's an issue with the building, I'm sorry, I'm not going to be waiting back. You know, I've got family that are reliant on me, so I'm not going to be putting my life in risk. Sadly, might be selfish, but, you know, we should have procedures in place. Now, if an evacuation chair was there, I'd be taking that person down the stairs straight away. And when you've used it a few times, you can actually use the stairs. I'm going to say you're probably 10 to 20% slower than someone just walking down the stairs. So again, it's not a real issue in terms of slowing down evacuation at all. You've still got other people that can get past you quite easily. But, you know, a smart and a staged evacuation plan, you would probably evacuate the floor, then bring the people with disabilities at the end to maximise speed if it was safe to do so. So,
yeah,
there's no excuse these days. We've got the technology. We just really need the building legislators to actually get off their backsides. You know, that ABCB did a regulatory impact statement on the evacuation of people with disability, I'm going to say 5 or 6 years ago, and then it just all got too hard for them, so they shelved it. So wow. It's sitting there. It was supposed to have been reactivated and reassessed a couple of years ago. I've sent them an email about it and haven't had a response. So again, no one really cares about addressing required legislative change to keep people safe.
Yeah. Yeah, well, look, there's certainly some ideas. You know what? They're not ideas. I think they're necessities that really, really need to be implemented across the board. And I really do hope that those listening to the Building Manager podcast can start implementing these situations and maybe need some changes, not only just in Australian standards, and I know there's standards, but also even through the NCC. Again, they're just standards as well, but you could read through those and you won't find too much about accessibility and disability and inclusivity, and it's quite sad, unfortunately. Well, Bruce, look, thank you very much for your time today on the Building Manager podcast. I really, really do appreciate your time. I know you're a busy man. How can people get in contact with you or get in contact to learn a little bit more about Equal Access Group?
Sure. Our main website is equalaccessgroup.com.au. That then has links off to our main organisation, so Equal Access Disability Access Consultants, SDA Consulting, Evacu Life, and also Access and Safety.
Perfect. I'd love to talk so much more about this. You're just as passionate as this as I am. I really do appreciate your time today, Bruce. And I wish you, your team, all the best for 2022. And hopefully we'll catch up soon.
Much appreciated. Thanks
Thanks,
for the
Bruce.
opportunity to speak.
Pleasure. Take care. Have a good day.
Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, thanks, Bruce Bromley, for joining me on today's podcast from Equal Access Group. Bruce, as you can tell, is an exceptional man who is really doing his best for everybody in regards to accessibility, disability, and inclusivity. And we certainly do share a great deal of passion about this industry. So thanks, Bruce, for sharing your time today on the Building Manager podcast. For those of you who wish to join the Building Manager podcast, feel free to get in contact with me via email, which is matt@elitebma.com. And I'll be more than happy to get back to you as soon as I can. Once again, a big shout out to all you building managers out there, keeping everyone safe, doing a good job. And I really do wish everybody who has gone through the floods running properties the very best in every way, shape and form. I know what it's like and certainly have compassion for you all doing it. So I do wish you all the very best. Thanks once again for joining me on the Building Manager podcast. My name is Matt Osborne and I've been your host. Look forward to talking to you all once again next week. In the meantime, take care. Bye for now.